Who's hosting?
You are, Adam, unless you don't want
shit.
To.
Okay.
Adam, are you going to be too zonked out?
I think, if anything, too zonked out would improve this show. This is the Punk News Podcast, episode 459. Welcome to Punkies Podcast. My name is Adam White, recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario, inches from death. Joining me on tonight's show, out of Philadelphia, which I assume is sort of like being from the wellspring of eternal life, so you'd never be inches from death, Mr. John Gentile.
Listen, nothing ever dies in Philadelphia. It just becomes it just evolves into a horrible mascot that represents the worst of humanity, and somehow people embrace that and see that as a survival mechanism, much like a cockroach. Morality is no more. There is only obnoxiousness and greed, and that's the world. Welcome to Philadelphia.
Yeah, but you got cheese sauce, right? So that's okay.
Cheese sauce?
Don't you? Don't you put on your cheese steaks? Yeah. Is it not?
I got that Rocky statue.
I got the Rocky soft pretzels, the Rocky statue. What else do you need?
Yeah, it's like a Wonderland on Earth. That voice you also heard, speaking of Wonderlands, was Mr. Tom Trauma.
Always near death. Always.
Always. Well, closer than me, at least chronologically.
Adam, I've seen so many people so much younger and so much healthier than me drop dead that I know I'm just on borrowed time, man. Living on borrowed time.
See, I feel a little bit cheated. This is like that John Lydon thing. I'm on stage in Texas with the Sex Pistols.
Yeah. Actually, do you mean San Francisco at Wonderland, Adam?
Was San Francisco? Was it Texas?
It was San Francisco. The Avengers opened. It was the last Sex Pistols show ever. And John Lydon closed the show with the phrase, "Have you ever feel like you've been cheated?"
Oh, shit. Well, I think it was Texas.
Exceptionally short show, right?
They played Texas that tour, did they not?
Yes. I think, yeah, yeah.
Anyways, I don't know. I don't do a podcast or anything. It doesn't matter.
It was an episode of Punk's Boys.
Yeah. All right. So, no, it is the it is September. It is the first week of September. We've completed our Labor Day duties, comrades, and now our children are all going back to school, right? So my son's going into kindergarten. Today was his first full day of kindergarten. My daughter's going into grade two. Everything's rosy.
My God, we've been doing this a long time, Adam, because I remember when your son was born.
Yeah, right? Like, the podcast predates my children, which is a really strange thing. Now, I had the realization a day ago that, all right, they're all going to go back to school. And then in a week, we're all going to get sick because they're going to go and they're going to go re-enter this disgusting petri dish of humanity that is a public school and pick up all everyone else's germs and bring them home. And then I'm going to get whichever of the germs has battled it out within the flesh of my children and has emerged as the super virus will then prey on me. And I assume that was going to happen. But I'm sitting here and I fucking feel like I'm sick. And it's been 2 days, so it can't be them. It's just like I had the little thought crept into my head where, we're getting to the season when there's colds and stuff. And then I instantly get one, like my body was just like, oh, shut her down, boys, and just fucking turned off. And now I have something. So this is the first in which will surely be a long series of Adam Cold Medicine podcasts. That is the drug of the season.
You need to build up your immunity, Adam.
I used to think I was. I'm like,
so well, like when you, as soon as your kids start sniffling, you need to drink a little bit of their snot.
Ugh.
Well, and see, I'm like a super. Like, I never get sick from that stuff anymore. You know, my kids are, I have one in high school, one in middle school, but you just got to build up your tolerance somehow or something.
I mean, kids are pretty good about, like, putting snot in your mouth involuntarily, so I usually don't have to lick them, but maybe they're becoming mature enough that I do now. They're going
to... Adam's out at the market, he picks up his kid and, like, licks his kid. Yeah. Like, it's like a piece of fruit.
Oh, so I don't know what's going on. This is the This is the first episode to chronicle my long and sorrowful death. That's what's happening. So anyways, before we get to whatever other misery awaits me on this show, any mail, John?
Yes, you can always just at podcast@punknews.org. This is from Jeff. Here's what Jeff has to say. And Adam, this actually might forecast episode 458. This is from Jeff. Jeff, yo, fellas. I just wanted to give a shout out to a couple Vancouver Canadian bands that are absolutely killing it lately. Sore Points and Chain Whip. I know Adam has mentioned Chain Whip before on his Some Party newsletter, but I saw both of these bands open for Nightbirds a few months ago and I fell in love. I ordered the new Chain Whip LP on orange vinyl, no less, and the singer Josh dropped it off at my work for me.
Nice.
I mentioned I occasionally wrote for
Beats Punk Amazon.
I mentioned I occasionally wrote for Punk News, and he says Adam knows me quite well. Regardless, nice dude. The point of this email is to get you guys to play Turner Street Ghost Motel on your podcast to give these guys some exposures. Love your work. Keep it real. From Jeff.
Yeah, we can do that. It was Turner Street Ghost Motel. Was that a Chain Whip track? Was that off the new one? Yeah, did I play a Chain Whip track last week, or did I just talk about them? I don't know.
I think you did, but we can play it again. Let's play it again. We got requests. We take requests.
We'll play that after the mail. Yeah, so Chain Whip is rad. Sore Points are rad. Sore Points actually were, weirdly enough, in an episode of the revived X-Files. So, you know, like, they made a new season of the X-Files for, I don't know, was it just on Fox, or was it on, like, one of these digital services?
I think it was like a combination. Like, it was made through Fox on one of these. I don't remember. I didn't watch it.
I don't know. Anyways,
I heard it wasn't that good. I love the original, though.
They film a lot of that stuff in Vancouver, and they actually filmed the original X-Files all in Vancouver as well. So they had some scene in one of those episodes in which, like, there is a punk band on stage playing, and it's fucking Sore Points. Sore Points had a record come out on Deranged last year, and it's really good. It is akin to, I want to say, like, Nightbirds in sound style and level of general aggression, maybe a little bit more on the Ramonesy side than the Nightbirds would be, but like they're from that ilk. They're good. Vancouver's good. Vancouver puts out so much stuff. I feel like a lot of people I know from Vancouver that live in the rest of Canada or that like interact with the rest of Canada feel that for some reason the Vancouver artists always get like short shrift from everyone else, but like Vancouver fucking rules. I could rattle off like 10 different Vancouver bands in the past year.
What's the pecking order in Canada? Obviously Toronto is your New York and your LA and one. Toronto, and then what's next? Montreal?
Toronto. Well, they call it Montreal, but Toronto is the biggest only because like it's where everyone gravitates to naturally, like for work and for careers. Like big, it's got the New York effect, right? But Montreal is cooler, I think, from an artist standpoint. It's just that, like, you know, if you live in Quebec, you have to deal with like a certain amount of the French Canadian bullshit that you may or may not want to have to deal with, depending on what you do.
That's kind of talk that'll get our podcast banned in the Great White
North.
Well,
no, but I mean, like, if none of these people that are in these bands are in those bands because it's their career. So if you're going to go, you know, camp your band out in Montreal, unless you're somehow could like exclusively can isolate whatever your working life is into like the English quarter of the city, it probably means you've got to get hip to speaking a little bit of Francais. And if that's a problem for you, it's maybe a harder place to just like move to. But everyone always moves to all these places. And whenever you try to, and I guess like Vancouver would be up there in that list, but there is something about them being like on the other side of the Rockies from the rest of the country that isolates them into their own little strange bubble. And that combined with the fact that like it is nigh impossible to find affordable housing there. It's one of those of those places that has like been completely priced out of like the average person by, you know, foreign buyers and speculators and stuff like that. Like the real estate in Vancouver, this is super interesting from a punk rock standpoint, is it's incredibly expensive in large part, as I understand it, due to like foreign buyers from China or Korea or something like that buying up all that property, because it's, you know, it's the closest sort of like flight distance from that area of Asia. So if you're going to go, you know, if you are a moneyed person from somewhere in the East and you're going to go buy up some property and you don't want to live in the States. Well, like it is, that's your option. So yeah, I would venture out though and say that the sleeper hit of the secret Canadian music cities these days is Hamilton.
That's not very far from me.
It's not very far.
That's closer to me than Toronto.
Right. And then what I've heard people, now everyone from Hamilton will hate this and it will make them want to punch things. But I have heard people refer to Hamilton lately as like the Brooklyn of Toronto. And it's just like in large part because everyone got priced out of Toronto. So if you wanted to, you know, if you wanted to go buy like a shitty rundown building and open a community theater in it or a venue or whatever you want. Like you aren't doing that in Toronto anymore. There's just like, it's too expensive. So you go to Hamilton, which is sort of like the next thing down the highway, and you do it there. And everyone's getting priced out of Hamilton. You know what happens when they get priced out of Hamilton, Tom?
They move to Niagara Falls.
They move to fucking Niagara Falls. So I'm banking.
But then they get to see you announce whatever hipster band is playing at the park.
No, but then I become their king. They show up and I'm already... I'm already like the big cheese.
Wow. Delusions of grandeur are running rampant tonight.
Because once they hit the border, where are they going to go? They're not going. They're not going to cross the border and go to Niagara Falls, New York.
They'll go to Buffalo, dude. It's a wonderful place to winter.
Buffalo is great, but they didn't go in there.
Our next letter. This is from Jerry with a G.
Dude, Buffalo is not great. Nobody ever said Buffalo was great. You don't have to kiss Buffalo's ass. They suck.
Here's what Jerry has to say. I listen every week and really like that you guys are back on schedule. My favorite thing is hearing new music and learning about new music. That begs the question, who on the Punk News podcast has the best taste? Mwa-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha from Jerry.
He's trying to start a fight between us?
I think so.
Well, I mean, we all think we have the best taste, so that's, you know.
Oh, no, I can.
I get where you're going there, Jerry, but it's obviously not Adam, because all he listens to is Canadian music.
No, but Tom's right. So here you go. Think about this. So I have purposefully.
I'm right that Adam has terrible taste. Thank you, Adam.
No, I have purposefully, as a survival mechanism, decided that I only have the time right now to pay attention to all this, like, this small underground shit that's coming out of Canada. And I do it at the exclusion, and I admit to this, at the absolute exclusion of other stuff. I'll see people go and, like, talk about some band, and I'll be like, all right, got to go look up on this band. And I go and I check, and it's from, like, Idaho, and I'm like, yeah, all right, never mind. And then I'll ignore it and go about my life. So by default, that means I am not making decisions based on what is best. I am making decisions based on some other arbitrary bullshit. So it ain't me. So who is it?
Well, you know, it's obviously, you know,
John.
Well, the difference between John and I think specifically is that I have a different attitude about things in that I'm not really, John tries to like, follow all genres of music, like, and I've already decided that too much of my life is gone to listen to hip hop or you know what I mean. I just don't care about hip hop. It's just not my thing. I don't dislike all of it. I mean, I have a little bit of it in my collection, like the first wave of like NWA, Public Enemy, that kind of stuff. I can kind of dig it. But
it's like saying I've had pizzas, so I don't need to have French fries anymore. You know what
I
mean?
I just don't have time.
French fries. So I don't need to get into it, man.
And I'm constantly reviewing something, so I'm very focused on a narrow genre of music. It's not geographic like the way Adam is, but I'm the same way. I mean, when I listen to music for pleasure, I'm listening to most 90% of the time when I listen to music for pleasure, it's either classic punk, 80, you know, the first Adolescence record, the first Suicidal Tendencies album, you know, Agent Orange, Gangrene, stuff like that, or like first wave thrash, Metallica, the Metallica represses are big on my turntable at the moment. So I don't know. I mean, I like the idea that you're trying to start a fight between us, but I just, you know, it's you know, objective.
Well, when I listen to music objective. For pleasure, it's the second objective. Album by The Damned. So I'll take the default win. Thank you, Jerry.
You can always
reach podcast at punknews.org. Adam, I guess we're going to play Chain Whip tune and then come back and hit him with the news.
Yeah. All right. This is a Chain Whip song. It's the one the guy said. Which one was it? Hold on.
A motel or something. Ghost
haunted
motel.
House or something.
No,
we'll get the real one. Hold on. So this is off 14 Lashes. It is a new Chain Whip record. It's great. You should go get it. Mine is in the mail as well. I don't think that Joel's going to bring it to me because Josh is going to bring it to me because that is many, many miles.
But it's the king of Niagara Falls. It's obviously worth the trip.
I mean, you'd think, right? But I can't account for the transit.
He probably doesn't want to deliver it to you because you'll probably give him some horrible disease.
At this point, well, okay. So I mean,
sneeze right on him.
I don't know if our
$16,000 to like deliver records to you. Like if you buy like a $16,000 Kiss record, Gene Simmons will deliver it to you personally. So you can do that, Adam. You can have Gene Simmons deliver the Chain Whip album to you.
See, I feel that. So Josh is a guy that I know runs distro out of his city. Like he runs distros like in this like 80s, like old school way. Like he will go and
boxes
buy like
sitting around his garage. Yeah,
he'll buy chunks of copies of a record and then he'll go out to the people that know that he bring stuff in and it'd be like, I got copies of this if anyone wants to buy one, right? I don't know how you do that and not go broke
or trade. Like trade. Like I'll trade you 15 7 inches for 12, you know.
Right. So I imagine that like with postal rates in this country, you only do distro for so long before you go fucking crazy because it's really expensive up here to ship anything. So you probably just hand deliver everything at that point because you're jaded. So this is the song Turner Street Ghost Motel. It is track 7, in case anyone wants to know, off of the new Chain Whip record, which is good. Here you go. Back, that was Chain Whip. So we have a lot of stories about old bands to talk about this week, which is fitting because we don't understand what kids like.
Because we're old.
Yeah, this is really the one thing that we have any ability to comment on. So first of all, there is drama within the Offspring. So over the past few months,
I thought we were going to talk about some good old bands.
Hold your applause for the Offspring until the end of the story, please. So over the past few months, Offspring's co-founder and bassist Greg Kreisel, how do you want to say that?
I would say Kreisel, but I don't know.
Kreisel, sure. has not been at any of the band's shows. They've played with a few people filling in. They had No Doubts. Tony Canal, who was he in your Dream Car band?
He was probably the main Dream Car.
All right, well let's rephrase this article then. So with Dream Car's Tony Canal,
Dream Car,
and H2O's Todd Morse filling in. Todd is the brother, right? He's not the singer. That's what Toby.
Toby Morse is H2O singer.
Yeah, so Todd must be his relation. Anyways, it appears that the band and the bassist are in the midst of a dispute. So there was a report that was filed by our comrades in arms there over at Dying Scene back in June, where he said that Kreisel sued the band as well as co-founders Dexter Holland and Kevin Wasserman under multiple causes of action in Orange County, California. Each action is rooted in the theory that the band has been underpaying Kreisel as a third owner of the band and is trying to cut him out of his rights as a third owner. So today, Punk News pulled the civil docket. Now, John, when you say that, does that mean today John pulled the civil docket? Because I wouldn't know how to, I wouldn't know how to fucking pull a civil docket, man.
That's precisely what that means.
Do I have access to do that?
You do.
I do. All right. There you go. So it's not
all civil filings in the United States are public info, so anyone can get them.
Oh, well, anyways, on August 1st, 2019, the defendants filed an answer denying the accusations and a cross complaint against Kreisel. The next hearing is a case management conference on October 18th, which will be a quick routine hearing where the assigned judge, Judge Melzer, will ask the parties about the discovery served and their estimated time frame for the matter, should it proceed to trial. So Offspring, let's contextualize a little bit what's going on here. They last released a record called Days Go By in 2012. They are currently on tour in Canada with Sum 41, I think.
Really? Who cares?
Yeah, well, did we talk about that on a past show?
I don't think so. I can't see you talking about Sum 41.
No,
really,
just
you know?
But I had it in the notes that I wanted to comment on it. In that it was one of the things in my life that I didn't understand, and I still don't understand it. But it is one of these things where, like, the local that show is coming to Niagara. It's coming to the to the big performing arts center in St. Catharines, and it is strange to me to look upon, say, Facebook, and see a bunch of people who I've never seen say anything about music one way or another, who I know from high school or from my day job or whatever, all of a sudden pop in and start talking about, this is punk rock show. We got to go to the punk rock show. And then, like, the newspaper is posting, like, the newspaper is writing, like, this as its news, like, punk bands coming to the Meridian Center. And I'm like, punk bands play in St. Catharines all the time at the venues that put on punk shows, but no one seems to give a shit. But you're all really excited because the Offspring are coming to play like an $80, $90 show or whatever the hell it's going to be. And I don't get it. I don't understand people or the world or the universe or anything. That has nothing to do with the story. It's just been bugging me for a while. Anywho, John, what can we glean from the legalities of this? This is
a very standard ownership dispute, and you see this a lot in bands, especially bands in the punk scene or almost in any scene that started out as bands first and then became a corporation later on. Offspring, I think, didn't incorporate till 1992 or 1993, or they either became a partnership or an incorporation. I can't remember. One of the two.
That was well before they hit it big, though.
Actually, I think it was just before they hit it big. It was probably when they got
94 was the year they broke.
Right, so they probably did just when they signed to a major label, which makes a lot of sense. Basically, there's three owners or three partners, the Offspring. I can't remember which it is. The legal significance would be almost identical in this context, in that the one guy is saying, you other two guys are trying to cut me out of my fair share. You were handling the accounting. I'm not seeing the accounting. You're stealing money from me and keeping it for yourself. I want my money. And they're saying, no, we didn't. We're paying you everything that we're supposed to be paying you. And it'll probably settle. It most likely will settle with Kreisel leaving the band and getting bought out by the other two members at an agreement acceptable to all three of them.
I was going to say, that's it for him and the band, unfortunately.
Yeah. But, I mean, honestly, if you remember, Offspring sold almost all their assets a couple of years ago, remember? They sold their albums for, like, a lot of money, and maybe that's what triggered this dispute. Maybe Kreisel didn't get the amount of money he was expecting, and maybe he feels as though a lot of got eaten up in, you know, administrative or other costs, which he thinks are not fair. And I'm not saying this is the case for Offspring, but here's a common scenario. Four guys own a business, right? One of the guys owns another business. Business A uses business B's assets, and business B pays himself. You know, so he's paying himself from the other company's assets. And sometimes they do it fair, and sometimes they help himself to a little or a lot extra, and they disguise it in costs. So I'm not saying that is the case here, but that's a common scenario. So there's nothing unique or surprising about this. Honestly, they're all probably kind of sick of being in the band. I would guess either probably it makes really good money. Creasel's probably tired of touring. And so maybe he is or maybe he isn't getting what's due to him. There's no way for us to tell, really. But this is going to settle, and he'll get a chunk of change, and he'll get bought out of the band at a mediation or an arbitration. Not at an arbitration or a settlement conference. And this is very common for bands of this stature and this age.
I like that the drummer never owned a share.
Is he still in the band?
No, I have no idea. I don't know who the drummer is.
The only guy I know
is the main guy, the singer guy, right?
Yeah, so like if they're a four-piece and they were third owners, then I guess the drummer is out. John, could Greg Creasel here, could he leave the band and form a, let's say, the Offspring GK and confusingly tour under the band's name with a bullshit acronym that only John Gentile understands?
I'd go with the classic Offspring 77.
How about Offspring AD?
There you go.
Or Offspring Inc. I mean, he could, and it would probably result in something.
Or Greg Creasel's Offspring,
and it would result. I mean, this is notorious with the '80s bands. There's like three LA Guns. There's like two Poisons, and they sue each other. And sometimes they agree to coexist in the States, and sometimes one of them is over in Europe, and one of them is in the States. Adam, they absolutely could, and I don't foresee that happening though. And here's why: when that usually happens, it's because the bands need the touring money to exist. The Offspring guys, they're set. None of them are going to tour unless they're making mega bank, and you're not going to make mega bank as Offspring GK. You know what I mean? So I realize you were being funny, but I chose to answer seriously.
No one ever realizes I'm being funny. It's because it never really works. All right. So anyways, that is the Offspring news. Adam continues to be confused about why people are excited about this tour. But
why do you accept the Offspring? I mean, the radio hits are kind of catchy, but I would not be like a fan of the band.
I will defend their first record, not their first record, but their last one when they made a big Smash. The two before that actually are sort of boring, but Smash, they really did catch some kind of lightning in a bottle, and it's still a surprisingly good record all the way through.
The Offspring,
but after that, they started chasing radio, and it got bad. I mean, it got bad fast. The album after that had a couple of decent songs and a couple of hits. By the time the next album came around, there was literally nothing worth listening to on their records.
Yeah,
I mean, they sold out at the speed of light.
Yeah, I'm not messing with the breakout '90s, Epitaph era Offspring stuff, because
the fact of the matter, Smash was on Epitaph. I think later it was picked up and distributed by somebody else, but it was an Epitaph record,
right? But I mean, like, if you even want to talk about like good things coming from other things, that record and the sales of which thereof like funded a fuck ton of what Epitaph did in the years subsequent to that.
Yep.
Like
they went ahead and signed Falling in Reverse. Thanks, guys.
No, I want to say the Offspring money was burnt by the time they got to the Falling in Reverse phase. So I don't want to put that blame on Offspring. But no, I mean, I'm like you, just like, you know, there was a time where, you know, Offspring were like one of the breakout punk bands getting into the mainstream, and everything was fine and it was cool, and they were recording grunge songs for the Batman soundtracks and whatever, and that was
when they first came out, I mean, they were playing halls and they were doing the legit circuit. They weren't one of these fake bands that had a fake label behind them. You know, they worked their way up.
No, it's just that they went down this road of like writing.
They made a choice. They decided to pursue fame with reckless abandon, and then their music was terrible.
But what I don't get is that how I got to the point, let's say 15 plus years ago, where I would listen to the Offspring stuff that was subsequent to their biggest stuff and went like, ugh, like this is starting to stink, like the shine is off. Right. And then moved on with my life. Whereas all these people that I went to high school with that are now real estate agents and insurance adjusters and stuff like that are just like, the Offspring, I'm fucking there. I'm like, well, huh? Like, have you not paid attention to anything? Like, this isn't like the 90s Offspring walking through a portal onto a stage. This is what we got now. I don't get it. I don't get it, but I'm not an average music person. I'm a weirdo in his basement that's dying of scurvy or whatever I have. So, you know, what are you going to do? So speaking of old, Tom Trauma is, no, Social Distortion, they are getting together for a 40th anniversary show. It's going to be in October in Irvine, California at the Five Point Amphitheater, October 26th to be precise. They are playing with Joan Jett, Frank Turner, and the Distillers have been announced for that show, with more probably signing up soon. They last released, and this feels like a million years ago for some reason, but they last released their seventh studio LP, Hard Times and Nursery Rhymes, back in 2011. So, Tom, how does Social D fit into your general, like, pantheon of bands? And I'm curious about your perspective of this in particular, right? Because
John is going to give me a hard time about this because we've actually gotten into this a little bit before, but they are among my handful of favorite bands.
Because like, I know
and
there's...
Like, I haven't really loved... And I haven't entirely loved an album since White Light, White Heat, White Trash, which was 1996. So, yeah, more than 20 years ago. But every album has some decent stuff on it. And I've always loved them. Matter of fact, they're playing Friday with Flogging Molly in Detroit. And it's my wife's birthday. And I really toyed with the idea of taking her. But that would really be more of a present for me. So I don't think we're going to go. But, no, I like Social D a lot. I know. And I think the thing with Social D, kind of like the offspring to the next generation, they're the easy band to pick on, the easy band to beat on. Oh, cis male, you know, nothing but a bunch of macho cis male bullshit. But they were just, you know, they're just a good band. Don't listen to them or whatever if you don't want. But I don't understand the hate for Social D particularly. Mike Ness can be a bit of a blowhard, but show me a, you know, 57-year-old man who isn't.
Oh my God. I see. I just had this moment where, you mentioned White Light, White Heat, White Trash. And I'm like, yeah, I liked that record a lot. And I thought to myself,
it's so good.
And I thought
it's
to myself,
so good.
What record is after that? And I went and I looked and the Punk News Reviews archive says it's probably like Sex, Love and Rock and Roll.
Sex, Love and Rock.
And then I click,
which had some decent stuff on it.
And then I click on that and it was reviewed by me in 2004. Nice. I gave it 4.5 stars, and I don't know if our star rating system has been a bell curve before or after then, probably. And I wrote like
it's constant evolution, the star system.
I wrote like 8 paragraphs about this, and I don't really remember that record at all.
Don't remember any of the songs.
this is the problem with the internet and me, is that like I'll find stuff that I wrote. Like we talked about, like, you know, recording this podcast before, you know, before my kids were born. Like I was writing for Punk News, like when I was from fucking high school. Like there is, oh my God, there are things online. I don't know. I need to change my name. I don't know if I can own all this stuff.
Well, you know, and that's funny, isn't it? Because you loved that record at the time. You thought it was great. You gave it 9 out of 10. Meanwhile, like records that came out when you were 15, you still know every word to. It's just where you were at the time. You know, it's all about where you were at the time.
I like trying to be an objective critic is just like bullshit. It's not a thing that happens. So anyways, though, but are you, what is your, what outside of the fact that your favorite Social D record has been like a number of years past?
Well, I don't even know if it's my favorite one. It's just the last one I love.
Right, right. But so do they retain, I don't know, like goodwill. Like to me, like the Offspring going back to that one, I have no goodwill for that band. Like I don't wish them harm or anything like that. Don't get me wrong. Like
except for that damn bass player.
But I remember like the moment where it all evaporated for me, and I'm pretty sure it was watching the Offspring play at either like on TV, but like from either, was it Woodstock 99 or 95 or like not to make everything about Woodstock on this show.
Yeah, it might have been a 94.
But they're playing that one of those horrible Woodstocks, probably in between all the Limp Bizkits and the Korns and stuff. So let's say it's 99, right? And they got on stage and there's like 60 billion people there, and that's fine. It was one of these Woodstocks. And every song they played from Smash or that era sounded spot on. And every song that they played from, like, any of, like, the goofy hits or Americana or anything after. I don't even know if there was a record after Americana.
Oh, come on. You know you're a pretty fly for a white guy fan.
Well, no, but, like, any of those songs, stupid though they may be, he couldn't sing them. Like it was clear.
Oh, they auto-tuned?
Yeah, it was clear listening to him try to sing them live that whatever they had come out of the studio had a lot of computer help to like smooth out the pips and squeaks of Dexter's natural voice. So I'm like, you know, recording all these joke rock songs is one thing, but recording all these joke rock songs and you can't even play them live, but that's what everyone's going to want to hear live, which means you're just subjecting everyone to hear you not being able to sing these songs forever. It's such a cynical, dumb thing to do as a band. I remember watching that even as late teen me and just being like, nope, like fuck it. I'm out. So did you ever get out with Social D? That's the question I was getting at.
No, not really. I would say, I mean, you know, I've seen them more than 10 times. They're one of the probably 15 bands that I've seen more than 10 times. And some shows have certainly been better than others. I can remember a couple specifically that I was not real thrilled with, but last time I saw them a year or two ago, I thought they were really quite good. So, no, I haven't really, I mean, your tastes always come and go over the years, you know? Like I one of my favorite albums of all time is the second Danzig album. It came out in 90. Boy, John knows. I think 90.
Danzig 2 is 1990. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've been listening to it for literally 30 years. I got it as a new release. But that doesn't mean I don't go 5 years without listening to it. I'm just on a kick right now where I'm listening to it a lot. You know, this is the way it ebbs and flows, but I never turn my back on Social D. It helps that they have such a long album cycle too. So you actually, you know, you're hungry for new material when the new material comes.
They have like a very Descendants style recording schedule, at least up until recently.
Well, you know, it's you know, and Mike Ness made two solo albums, and one of them is brilliant and one of them is good. And yeah, they just, you know, they have such a weird audience too, you know, because there's a lot of old punks at their shows, but they also have that kind of weird gearhead audience. That kind of,
yeah, the there's a lot of like Social D is a creaser band. The creeper
wearing, yeah, you know, stray cat, stray. Yeah.
A lot of pompadours, a lot of like,
pretty much
like, they cross into that psychobilly crowd for some reason. And yeah, I mean,
that white trash album. I know John's not a Social D fan. He probably never really got into the album. But the fact of the matter is, any of you, I can't imagine how any recovering Catholic couldn't appreciate that album, because that album is his sort of coming to grips with the way he was raised. And I think it's a brilliant album. It's 23 years old. I still stand by it.
Totally unrelated note to anything. I sat through a full Catholic mass today.
Did you really? On Wednesday?
It was a funeral. But like I'm one of those lapsed Catholics.
Hey, good news, last one for that guy.
Well, yeah, but it was one of those ones where it was a Catholic mass. I was raised Catholic. It's one of those things where like I can recite what's going on out of memory. Now this one was like kind of in French, so it was a little bit harder for me to recite what was going on out of memory. But woof, talking about like weird conflicting feelings. I like to think I'm mature enough that I can sit there for a Catholic mass at this point and not be
an adult.
Like be an adult in it. And I feel like I was, right? I wasn't like booing or anything. But
I would like to see the priest come out and kick your bony ass.
I'm just like,
that's
like,
enough out of you.
I'm just like, I'm so conscious of it when I'm there, you know? It's like I'm like
if I would have known you were gonna boo me, I would have raped you when you were younger.
Yeah, moving on. So John, you do this, you read this Mike Park story because you have a spin on it here.
Oh yeah, listen, if you want to know how to be an aging punk rocker, don't follow in the wake of Social Distortion because they're old and boring and were never good. Follow in the wake of Mike Park, a man who has done many interesting things over the course of his career and continues to do so. I'm not a mega fan of everything that Mike Park has done, but I am a fan of a lot of what he has done. He's turning 50 this year, so he's throwing himself a 50th birthday party. He's throwing two shows at Bottom of the Hill in San Francisco and the Excellent Venue on November 8 and 9. Here's the kicker. Asian Man Records has had many bands to go on to, I don't want to say bigger and better things, but bigger things. Alkaline Trio, Bomb Music Industry, Lawrence Arms, you name them. Well, that's them. Those are the three. Andrew Jackson Jihad. What was that, Tom?
You're right. There's been quite a few. I mean, that's
Jackson Jihad, Classics of Love, And so
Plastic Love, they were the best band ever, and they went on to nothing.
I know, man. There is no justice in this world, and that Classics of Love was so amazing. And I think we three were the only people that cared. You know what I mean? As a side note, I saw every single Bay Area Classics of Love show, and I got to watch them evolve, and it really was amazing. I mean, man, what a bummer that band's not around anymore. Anyways, so Mike Park says he's got some special openers, but he's not going to say who they are before the show, because if he did, the show would sell out and
scout. Oh, it's going to be Classics of Love, John. Is that your theory?
No, I don't think it's going to be Classics of Love, because we're going to be like, care about Classics of Love. And I think Jesse Michaels doesn't really feel like performing right now, although I don't know. And the other members of the band are spread out all over. But that's a good point. Yeah. We could guess who's going to be the opener. Here's my
guess. Isn't Classics of Love Jesse and the Hard Girls? Isn't that Classics of Love?
It is, but the Hard Girls are now in three different states and in three different time zones.
Oh, are they? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyways. So I think the opener is going to be Jeff Rosenstock, because he's still tight with Mike Park, because he's on the new Bruce Lee album band. And I think the other opener is going to be either Lawrence Arms or Alkaline Trio or maybe AJJ. And anyway, the point being is Mike Park, he's putting out records himself still, and they're interested. You know, a lot of them are a little soft for me, but I appreciate that he's doing what he wants to do. And I do think there's some real integrity and cleverness behind his record. The point being is, here's a big show with some stars. Let's do it. He's doing an interesting thing at a local small show place where if you're a fan and you want to go, you're able to get tickets to go for a reasonable price, and it's going to be a cool evening. And I think this is the way to do it.
I venture out that secret openers are Lawrence Arms and Less Than Jake.
Good Ooh, guess.
Will you be going to those shows, John?
No, I did go to the Asian Man Records. I think it was 15th anniversary. I think it was. That was amazing. It was like, it was Bruce Lee band, or actually Mike Park solo, Gnar Boots, Classics of Love, Kepi, and some a Dog Party. And it was an awesome show. I did go to that. I'm not going. It's just because, I mean, it's cool.
Too far to go. I get you. Yeah. I get you. You're on the East Coast.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny with my, you know, I am really not much of a ska fan, and I've made no bones about that. So I'm not necessarily a huge fan of Mike Park's music, but man, I like Mike Park, having never met him. Even he used to do like a weekly newsletter, and it was just so positive, and I just like the dude. I'd like to support him more, and any records that he's put out over the years that I've liked, I've always done mail order through Asian Man. But I'm not a ska fan, you know. I'm just not.
As a side note, have you noticed that on Mike Park's Twitter, I don't know if you follow him on Twitter, he's been somewhat angry lately, and rightfully so. He's angry at the state of the world. He's angry at people's rudeness, which I appreciate. Although, you know, Mike Park is often represented as, you know, Mr. Positivity, you know, Mr. Kindness, Mr. Niceness. I think that's good. However, I think when someone's always positive, when someone's always happy, I think they're not facing the reality of the world. Sometimes the world is not nice, and that needs to be addressed. And I like that Mike Park is now addressing that, because it's my opinion that simply being strictly positive all the time is somewhat of a denial of reality or existence. Whereas if you do appreciate that, you know, bad things and annoying things and bad things are out there, that's a more healthy outlook towards life. That's my perspective.
But you could take the attitude, John, that there's plenty of that stuff out there, and you don't need to put more of it out there.
True, but I mean
that doesn't make mean you don't acknowledge it, or that it's, or that you're some kind of a Pollyanna type. It just means that you're not gonna, for you, it's, you know, you're not gonna use your energy to put stuff like that out there.
True, but I mean, if someone's a dick to you and you're like positivity, I think that's unhealthy. If someone's a dick to you, I think it's, man, I'm mad or something, like, you know what I mean?
Just straight face punch and just settle it.
Right there, drop them right there. Anyway,
you know what, John? Honestly, I think that a society where everyone's afraid of getting punched in the face all the time is a polite society, because you could tell there's a lot of people now that have no fear of getting punched in the face, and they really should.
I second that emotion. Speaking of people that will punch you in the face, Paint It Black. They're recording a new EP. It was a bit of a surprise and a bit of a leak, and Punk News had the exclusive world breaking news on this. But here's the question. Is the Paint It Black train, hype train, broken down? And I don't mean that negatively, but, you know, Paint It Black, they've been a band now, I don't know, 15 years, a long time, and they've been mostly inactive the past 5 or 6 years. One of the main reasons is I think the guys live on opposite coasts, Dan Yemin, I think he's really more in his professional career, and I don't think he's doing too much with music these days. And Andy Nelson is now playing full-time at Ceremony, which I'm sure is not a full-time job, but it's a lot, you know. And so the in a Reddit Ask Me Anything, Andy Nelson revealed that Paint It Black has recorded a new EP. It will be out this winter, and they're going to do at least one show in 2020. And people were excited, but people didn't go crazy over this, you know, whereas, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, Paint It Black was like the hardcore band, you know. Now, since then, there have been many other excellent hardcore bands, and so maybe they've stepped aside and maybe that's okay. But will the new Paint It Black EP, will it, you know, create some ways where people be like, yes, Paint It Black is back, kind of like Tragedy used to be? Like, Tragedy only put out a record like every 7 years, and when it came out, people like freaked out, except for the last one. But so Paint It Black's, the new EP, will it be an afterthought, or will it be, you know, a prophesized return to greatness once every 5 years, like Pennywise or Return of the Jedi or Karate Kid?
You're just saying things now that have no meaning, but
Dark Crystal Prophecy.
I haven't watched it yet. Isn't it good?
No, I haven't seen it, but I hear it's real good. I'm excited. Mm.
I've never thought of Paint It Black as a full-time band. It always seemed like a cool side project by people that have real day jobs, like people that have the credibility and the name recognition from the, you know, the teenage bands that they did tour around relentlessly with and that were cult bands, and then they kind of came back and like turned that cred into doing something actually really cool. So I'm totally fine with Paint It Black showing up and releasing a 7-inch every 5 years or something like that. It seems totally appropriate for, at least for how I've always thought of them. So I'm down with that. I like Paint It Black. I like them a lot.
Prophecy.
I think, you know, I think people do forget about things, you know, and the people who were 25 when Paint It Black was really the hot band are now in their 30s and starting to have kids and have real jobs and stuff. So I think it's going to have to be a good record to bring them back. I'm pretty sure it will be, honestly. I never really heard anything by them that wasn't pretty good. So,
but can you do an EP? Like, if you put out a mind blowing album, you know what I mean? That could really break waves.
Well, maybe that's all they can do, John. I'd rather have 10 great minutes than 35 mediocre minutes.
But I'm saying if they put out an amazing EP, a new band that puts out an amazing EP can certainly create ripples. But can an established band that just puts out a 7-inch EP, can that establish ripples? Or will that be, yeah, it's a good new...
If they're that long, they probably can, yeah.
It depends what they're trying to do with it and what kind of press they're going to put behind it. So, I mean, my example here, and I don't want to equate these two bands at all because they kind of, in my mind, are from different, I guess they're from the same era, but they're from different age groups and different communities and stuff like that. But so like Alexis on Fire got back together not too long ago to play a bunch of shows, and they've released, I think, 2 one-off 7-inches I don't even think they're EPs. I think they're like just like 7-inches, like one song one side and the other side is an etching or something like that, right? But they put out these 2 7-inches. There's no album per se that has been announced or anything like that yet. But I'm pretty sure that those 7-inches sold incredibly well for Dine Alone and kind of like, you know, went out to this rabid fan base. And so I think like if the fan base,
of course, did they only make 500 of them, each of them or something?
I don't know, but I think it's definitely one of those things where, like, they know that they could roll into town, and as long as it's the right town, do a reunion show, and all these people would show up out of nowhere and just go apeshit about it. So if you can sell, like, cool 7-inches to those people, and you're content with putting stuff out to your fan base, I think that's okay. I think it's different when you do a full length. There's... To me, like that speaks that you are intending to go out into the world, tour behind that record, try to get it reviewed in the major publications. Like putting out a full length, in a lot of ways, to me, is a statement where like you want that to be a major mile marker of your band that you're putting out there, and you want people, not just the people that like you already, to really stand up and pay attention to it. Because like if you weren't listening to Paint It Black in the first place, The fact that there's a 2 or 3 song single out there about them is probably not even going to cross your radar. Unless they really got the press to, like, they really put a PR machine behind it. But even so, I'm totally willing to bet that, and I have no stats for this, but I bet you it's harder to get that kind of stuff reviewed. Like, from the perspective of, like, a publication, you know, oh, you want to write about the new big record from this band, and it's, you know, it's their new big return full length, and, like, the publications will hype that up themselves without needing the PR to do it for them. But if it's just, like, another 7-inch single or something like that, for all but, like, the biggest bands in the universe, I imagine that a lot of publications wouldn't give it the same amount of, same inches on the page or same amount of screen space or anything or whatever you want to call it on the internet than it would. So I think that factors into it. It's like what you want to do with it.
Prophecy. Last question. Why did Open City not really catch on?
Who was all in Open City?
I never listened to him. I don't know.
Open City was Dan Yemin, Andy Nelson, so the backbone of Painted Black, Rachel Rubino of Bridge and Tunnel, and Chris Wilson of Ted Leo's band of Titus Andronicus now, and a bunch of other bands as well.
Open City was a shade more discordant than Painted Black, were they not?
Yeah, it was more post-punky. The songs were longer, more amorphous, if you will.
Like, Painted Black is a hardcore band, but, like, they were a hardcore band that I feel that like had the songwriting chops behind it, in which you could dissect a Painted Black song and go like oh, I get the poppiness of this, like, I get why it's catchy.
Melody, head melody, right? Definitely.
Whereas something like Open City, you know, the pedigree of the members is sort of what you're going on, because they're going to be, like, weirder on purpose. So it's one of those things. You can't please everyone, especially if you're going to be in, like, a weird noise band. I mean, I appreciate everybody being in a weird noise band. I think I encourage it, but I don't think that's what the people want. I don't know. We should play a song.
Have I played Lotion before, or have I just talked about Lotion?
Is this song from the 30s? It's the dirtiest song ever? Because
no,
it's a Japanese hardcore band, isn't it?
No, it's a synth punk band. I have played that because there was an episode where Adam and I both played some synth punk. So instead of playing Lotion, I will play an interesting track by Painted Black. How about that? Let's do one of my more preferred Painted Black songs. Let us do the song I call Two Wheels for Wings, but I think it's called I don't know. This is a song by Painted Black. They're real cool. I dig them. Dan Yem and I have butted heads before on Twitter over Jamaican music, and I hope one day he and I resolve that conflict. This is by Painted Black.
Gallows overhead. The settings on paper.
All right, we're back. John, this is such a you story. I'm giving it to you as well.
So we're talking, okay.
This is our black flag.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. This is an interesting story. So, of course, Thomas, who was the original drummer for Black Flag?
Oh, he only played on Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables. Or was DH already in the band by then? No, he played on the first album, right? I can't remember.
Did you hear what I heard?
Huh?
The first drummer of Black Flag was Brian Migdahl. He is on the Nervous
Breakdown. Brian, I was thinking Dead Kennedy. I'm sorry. I'm like, didn't play on the first. Wow, sorry, dude. I mean, that's got to be like old man soft brain. You said Black Flag. I heard that,
and I just went right along with it and did not question the direction you were going.
That's why we're the posers, and John's going to give us an education here.
I can blame Cold Medicine. Now
that
you said
that name, it sounds familiar. But no, what? Because the Dead Kennedys had a drummer for a different drummer, either on the first album or before the first album. And,
right, isn't that Ted is his name?
Or just Ted, that's right, just Ted.
Yeah.
All right,
I get it. And speaking of being yelled at,
also a great drummer.
So, sometime he asked me about the time East Bay Ray yelled at me about putting up the wrong drummer of Dead Kennedy's picture. Anyways, so Brian Migdahl, he's the original drummer for Black Flag. He was only in the band, it's unclear, but probably just a couple of months. He's on the Nervous Breakdown EP, and he's also probably on Everything Went Black, and he also may very well be on Jealous Again, but probably not. He was not even sure, as was the fashion of the time. He put on a one-off show this past weekend, and he's also putting out an album. The album is called My High School Rebellion, and honestly, like, the cover art is not that great. However, at the show, he had a whole bunch of people that he knows come up and play Black Flag songs with him and other stuff. Des Cadena was there. Bill Close of the Freeze was there. Casey Royer of DI was there. Susie of the Turbulent Hearts was there. Don Balls of the Germs was there. Stacey D of Bad Cop was there. Monkey of the Attic was there, and a whole bunch of other people. And he did a show where all these people came up and did all these classic tunes, and it looked like everybody had a lot of fun, and it looked like it was really important and meaningful to him. But here's the thing. Is this cool fun, or is this somewhat undignified because he's the Pete Best of Black Flag, if you will? Like, if Pete Best got a whole bunch of people, and he did a bunch of Beatles songs. Would that be?
I mean,
cool?
Didn't Pete Best tour the States a few years ago playing really early Beatles songs?
Maybe he did. I feel bad for Pete Best. Do you know why Pete Best got kicked out of the Beatles? Because he didn't feel like going to one of their shows for, like, one day. So Ringo came by, and they realized Ringo was way better than Pete Best, and they fired Pete Best.
Man, how bad was Pete Best? Because let's face it, Ringo is hardly John Bonham.
I feel like there is a...
My son's a huge Beatles fan, like my 15-year-old son. So he loves to sit around and watch the Beatles. And his favorite thing to say is, did Ringo get paid as much as everybody else? Because it's just like such a low-effort style of drumming. You know what I mean? It's like he doesn't even have to use his... Just, it's all in the wrist, you know?
So when you said that, it jogged my memory that at one point, there was a potential Punk News Pete Best thing, and I was trying to find it, and I just thank God for Google Archives. So I just searched it out, and in September 7th of 2005, we got an email with the subject: Pete Best, the Beatles' original drummer, available for interviews, and unfortunately he is labeled as Pete Best, the man who put the beat in the Beatles, which is anyways,
you know, that's good marketing though, Adam. You got to give him that.
This was so Pete Best was doing press because a company called Lightyear was releasing a DVD called Best of the Beatles on August 30th, which I can guarantee you is not the best of the Beatles, because Lightyear, whoever that is, did not have the rights to that. This was stuff about Pete Best, who was of the Beatles. So anyways, I forwarded this email off to Scott Heisel, Aubin, and Brian Schultz, and I I asked, who thinks I should interview Pete best? It would be awesome. And no one responded. No one responded to my email.
You should have, Adam. You blew it.
That is such a John Gentile thing, is that you wouldn't have asked. You would have gone and fucking interviewed Pete best, right? But don't know what to say. Why are we talking about Pete best? Because of the Black Flag drummer.
I'm trying to find an archive of his touring, because I swear he toured, but he went and worked at the post office or something. Like, he had a normal job after the Beatles, but then he retired and then he started playing again. And I'm just trying to find.
Listen, if you guys were Pete Best and that you basically walked your way out of the world's most famous group, could you go on with your life or what?
I can barely go on with my life now, John. And I haven't missed out on any major opportunities that I know of.
Oh, holy shit. Something happened today that I think might make me into the Pete Best of a certain situation. So listen to this.
Oh, this is great. I got a set list here. Just a second.
I would like to point out how far we are off of the story about Black Flag's original drummer.
Screw that guy. Show.
Okay, so my wife took a picture of my two children, who I am fond of, and put it on Instagram, and they were both holding a cookie. Now, the cookie that they were holding, once or twice a year, there's this charity drive that the local Tim Hortons do, where you pay a buck and they give you a cookie where they've like drawn a smiley face on it with frosting, and it goes to some local charity. So she had gone and she put this picture on Instagram a couple of years ago. Both my kids standing there happy because they have one of these cookies in their hand. Well, she gets a Instagram message today from Tim Hortons, like the coffee chain, and was like, "Hi, we love your this picture of your children. It's adorable. Would you be okay if we like put it on our socials and like and on some in-store displays?" And I'm like, you know, wife, the answer to that is $50,000. That's what you should respond to these people. And she's like, no, I'm, I think this is adorable. And I'm so flattered. I'm like, no. They are a heartless, soulless corporation. They're owned by the Burger King conglomerate. They don't care about anyone or anything or our children.
Adam, you need legal representation right now.
I do, because I need custody of that photo because as it stands, everyone in the family is like, oh, wouldn't it be adorable if your children were part of this thing? And I'm like, no, because they're gonna go and they're gonna make a billboard that's like 1 million feet tall, and it's gonna say Adam White's Children endorses the Proud Boys, which has now been acquired by Tim Hortons or something like that. And
King of the Posers,
and I'm not gonna Adam get paid White shit is. For it, and I'm gonna have to deal with the consequences. I don't know what to do. And then I don't know how that makes me. It kind of makes me the Pete Best of this this burgeoning photo debacle.
His last live show was in 2018, and he's playing some coffee shop in Liverpool. And the set list was My Bonnie, like the old Robert Burns, like Scottish traditional song. My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean. You guys know that one?
Yeah. Safe
Twist
song.
And,
safe
Twist song. And Shout, which was a cover.
Yeah.
To begin with. Roll Over Beethoven, another cover. And then I Saw Her Standing There. That was a set. Now, I Saw Her Standing There. Is that old enough that he might have played on it? Maybe.
It could be.
Well, guys. Well, kids, if you get a chance to see the Pete Best Band, don't miss it. Sounds riveting. Plays old Scottish poem songs.
I'd go. If I had nothing else to do and it wasn't that expensive, I'd go.
It's at the last time I played was at the Casbah Coffee Club. And the last time before that, the Casbah Coffee Club. Man, they better have beer at that coffee club. So I'm going to sit there and watch a bunch of old men ramble through some old Beatles songs. I'm going to have some beer.
Well, listen, Adam, I don't know if you want to handle the next story or not. It's the opposite of Pete Best.
Yeah, so there's a pair of stories here that we're linking up because suddenly Mike Watt is super busy. So
Mike, he's the new Mike Yerk.
Yeah, Mike Watt's the new Mike Yerk. So Mike Watt has at least two new bands that he has formed. So the one that you can actually hear music from right now is called Fitted, all in caps. I don't know if that matters. It's called Fitted. It is Mike Watt, Graham Lewis, and Matthew Sims of Wire with Bob Lee of The Freaks. So it was originally formed a couple of years ago as just a one-off gig, but they've now gone and recorded and gotten the studio, so they're going to release their debut album. It's going to be called First Fits. It's out November 8th on a label called Org Music, that is not us. And you can listen to a song called Training Pit Bulls for the Navy over at Punk News. And it's cool. It is
it's a cool. I didn't listen to it.
It's cool. It is appropriately, it's a Mike Watt song, clearly. Like, you know,
he's another guy that I like, but I find his music to be a little funky for my taste.
Yeah, it's got a lot of Mike Watt funk on it, but it's good. It's cool. So, but that's the one of the two. So then number two here. So Mike Watt and who is it here? Todd Conglier. Yeah, so they have a new project. It is called Jump Started Plowhards,
which is a guy from Toys from Kill.
Which
Toys
is a Kill. Cool name.
Adam, you look. See, I'm not dissing Mike Watt or Todd, and it sounds cool. You think that's a good? I think that's a terrible name. Like, it's just annoying. It doesn't seem to make any sense.
It's a good name in that, like if you are going to go form a new band every 3 weeks with various buddies to either play some shows or record a handful of songs, and you all know that band has a limited shelf life, and then you're going to move on to something different. I think it's totally appropriate to give that band some wacky names.
Fair enough. I'll co-sign that.
Yeah. Some of the people from Tough Age, they went and they formed a band that was like everyone in Tough Age plus a member or two, and it was called Rotten Column. But they were like really like over the top, goofily punk. So calling it Rotten Column kind of fit. And now a few of the Rotten Column members left, so they've kind of reconstituted, and I'm pretty sure the new band is called Grape or something like that. And it's just like, yeah, it's all the same personnel cycling around, so just give it a goofy name and move on. So anyways, I'm back to this band here. So Jumpstarted Plowhards is the name of the band. So they're recording with a whole bunch of different drummers. So they've got George Hurley
from Pete Best?
Not Pete Best, but maybe. It's a long list. George Hurley from the Minutemen and Firehose. You got Patty Schmeel from Hole.
Patty Schemmel? Do you mean Adam? Patty Schemmel?
Jesus Christ! I can't. Cold medicine, John. I can't read in the first place. I don't want to blame the cold medicine. Nick Aguilar from Neighborhood Brats. Jimmy Felix from Toys That Kill. Jerry Trebonic from Mike Watt and the Second Men. Trevor Roundsville from Clown Sounds. Who else here? Brian Burnick from Fart Barf. Who's Fart Barf, John?
I don't know.
Sounds like a Canadian band, Adam.
I don't know about that. And Raul Morales, who played with Mike Watt and the Missing Men. So anyways, so their debut release is going to be called Round One. It comes out on a 12-inch 45 RPM record on Recess Records on October 4th. Recess is, of course, owned by Todd from Toys That Kill. Most of the songs were recorded by Watt, recording bass lines to a click track. He'd then send a CDR of the recordings to Todd, who would then build off of Watt's work with a bunch of different drummers. He was then brought back in at the end to finish the songs. And the group plans to release five records total.
Does Todd sing or does Mike sing? Or is that not clear? Or are they both sing?
I believe they both sing.
Yeah, there's nothing to hear from it yet. So hard to say. But they're going to release five records total before playing live. So round 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then the band will go schedule some shows. I mean. Do we need to discuss whether we approve of Mike Watt or not? Because like, I assume we do.
Mike Watt can do whatever the hell he wants.
But here's the thing. Is he spreading himself too thin? Like Mike Watt has got a million projects. I will say I saw his Italian band live, and it was like the record is okay. Live, they were amazing because it was actually like much like punker for some reason live. But like Mike Watt like does a project a week. If he just sat down and did one project over a couple of years, would it be amazing? Or is creativity not a limited well, if you will?
It's almost the same answer as, you know, should Paint and Black put out a full length or a 7-inch, where it's probably a similar situation to what a lot of the Melvins do, right? Where if you have the privilege of being a musician that is a career musician, and that you wake up in the morning and you play music, and you wake up the next day and you continue to play music, and you have a built-in fan base because you are, you know, let's say you're the Melvins or you're Mike Watt or you're, I mean, to a lesser degree, Dan Yemin. You know, I guess you got to make that choice. Do you want to make art and put it out, and if people dig it, they dig it, or do you want to make art according to a marketing scheme? Because I'm sure that whoever Mike Watt works with for PR, if anyone, probably hates this, right? Because there's a complete different mentality that clicks in as soon as a PR person is involved, because they're not looking at, you know, what cool thing are you doing? Let's tell people about it. They're looking at how everything that you are doing in addition to that is going to affect the impact of the thing that you put out, right? So right now, I'm working on this compilation that some party's going to put out, and I'm lining up the bands that are on it. And the few of them that I kind of had to turn down being on this volume of it were ones that had they're a little bit bigger or big enough that they had someone helping them make decisions. They weren't just making the decisions themselves. And it would often come down to okay, we know that we have a record coming out in November that we want to be touring behind. And if this thing comes out, you know, the month before or the month after, it kind of muddies what we have to put out into the press and this, that, and the other, right?
Who are you reaching out to that big? The Beatles?
No, I mean, bands can take
not
that.
Not the Beatles, John, the Pete Best Band.
But no, but it doesn't, you don't have to be a big band to get into that mindset. You just have to have someone involved, either a manager or just someone in the band that's acting as a manager, that's actually looking at things with like a 5,000 foot view of what you're doing and what messaging the band's trying to put out there. And, you know, I can't fault them for it, because if you're trying to get out there on the road and everything, and you have to make strategic business decisions sometimes, you know, as unpunk as that sounds.
And I'm going to guess that the Sum Party website is not paying a huge dividend. You know, looking for people to essentially, you know, give you the music for cross publicity.
Yeah. Well, I mean exactly. Right. And at a certain point that can work, but you don't necessarily, that's not necessarily going to work if you know that you have a record coming out, and you've gone and you've done the plan where you say okay, you know, 4 weeks before the record comes out, we're going to put out this song and we're going to try to get it on the biggest publication that we can. So we're going to try to shop it around to, you know, we want this song to premiere on, say, Brooklyn Vegan or Stereo Gum or one of those bigger music sites, right? And then as we get to the week before, you know, sure, we'll see. We'll throw Punk News a bone and see if we can get them to write about it. But we know that 2 weeks before, we got to put out this music video that's going to, you know, go out on this from this big radio station, or it's going to show up on the Rolling Stone news feed or whatever, right? You plan all that shit out. And if all of a sudden in the middle of that, it's like, Adam's got you on this comp and he's promoting it, you know, he's just out here rogue promoting it. You know, it does potentially get in the way of what you're trying to do strategically. So if you are Mike Watts, PR person, to kind of circle it back to him, you definitely don't want him out there having 52 simultaneous projects, because there's no way to adequately talk about that in a way that the publications that you're trying to get to talk about it aren't going to care necessarily. Because I could totally see Pitchfork say, turn around and go, you know what? We like Mike Watt in principle, but you know, we're a big popular website. The we don't just publish news all day. The news we publish is considered to be premium real estate. So if you're going to come at us every week with new Mike Watt news, we're at some point going to filter it out. Right. So, yeah. So from a PR standpoint, you totally don't want to spread yourself so thin. But if you just don't give a fuck because you're Mike Watt and you're kind of awesome, you can do whatever you want.
Mike Watt, Mike Watt does do just whatever Mike Watt wants, and that's why he's great, you know.
Well, and he probably has to do all these things to try to eke out some kind of a living. He probably has to stay on the road as much as possible. Yeah. You know, it's not like – I doubt those – I doubt Greg Ginn signed a lot of Minutemen royalties check, you know.
You don't say.
I'm guessing, you know, speculating.
Yeah, you got to save that ink for something important. Pens aren't cheap. All right. I lost my list of stories. What else are we talking about right now?
I think the only one other one. Let's take a look here. Oh, Municipal Waste. Okay. They're putting out a new EP. Listen, is the joke over? I mean, like, I've seen Municipal Waste. It's cool. It's a lot of fun. But I mean, like every night they're like, let's party, let's smoke some bongs, let's boogie board. Is the party over, or is it still kicking? You know what I mean?
The reason I would say that the party is still kicking is not because of the party itself, but rather because the music still rips, you know? I mean, are they in danger of self-parody? Absolutely. But I don't think they're quite there yet.
Isn't Municipal Waste a parody of metal, essentially? With thrash metal? Like, aren't they?
I think it's a genuine...
Really? See, I always thought that Municipal Waste was literally just an Exodus, but more self-aware.
I mean, there's a lot of inside jokes on you know, with Municipal Waste, but I don't think they could do it the way they do it unless they genuinely love the music. I don't think it's a parody band in the purest sense.
Is there anything else for us there, though? You know what I mean? Like,
just some great ripping songs and great riffs and breakdowns and fast parts and funny sarcastic lyrics. See, I wouldn't say they're like Exodus. I'd say they're more like, because Exodus was very self-serious, you know.
Exodus is funny. Toxic Waltz.
Yeah, I suppose.
I love that. Exodus is like not my favorite thrash band.
But I was gonna say maybe closer to like Anthrax, but because they always were kind of good at being lighthearted too. But
songs, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I like this. I'm looking forward to hearing this. But I might be, you know, these bands that haven't been around as long need to constantly be putting stuff out. You know, there's a new Toxic Holocaust album coming out. Toxic Holocaust is about 15 years old, I think, I would guess. But Todd Grind, Joel Grind, the main guy from Toxic Holocaust, does so much production stuff. Like, if you buy a heavy record, there's a pretty good chance that he had a hand in it at some point, either mastering or even recording or whatever. So he doesn't really have time to do his own stuff. But, you know, it's been 6 years since their last album. I just got the promo. It's good stuff. It was a cross between, like, Exodus and Venom or something. But, anyway, what were we talking about? I don't know. Municipal Waste. I'm cool with them still.
I'm cool with them. I'm just not sure there's anything left there to mine.
Although I will admit that I probably prefer Iron Reagan to Municipal Waste, even though it's essentially a very similar project. Adam has no idea who these people are.
No, I do. I'm not sure how to answer like the party over thing. I mean, if Municipal Waste, I mean, talk about bands of this scale, right? If Municipal Waste was so massive that their shtick, I don't know, like resonated throughout the culture, yeah, all right, you probably can't do that kind of thing for that long. But I mean, the bands,
they're never getting above a club level band,
yeah not right. So I mean, it's like all things, you're playing to the people that. That enjoy you at that point, and that's
not necessarily bad. In the fall. They are doing a tour in the fall, and I want to say it's Municipal Waste, Napalm Death, and Sick of It All. It is a sick, sick lineup. And I mean sick the way the kids mean it. Like, cool.
Napalm Death does cool tours, and that they tour with bands that are unlike them, but just like a common thread, you know?
I'm holding out for the Five Finger Death Punch Napalm Death tour. But this band, this new Guar tour, are you going to catch this leg of the Guar tour, John?
I am. I saw Guar last time, and you know, you have to accept it's never going to be as great as it was with Brocky. Once you accept that,
the most— No, but it's better than it was the first couple of tours without Brocky.
Exactly, exactly. I really enjoyed it last time. I truly did.
Yeah, Municipal Waste, Napalm Death, Sick of It All, and Take Offense. Man, that's killer. I'm not going. It's on a Wednesday night in Detroit, but still, it's killer. I've seen Gwar, I'm going to guess, at least 15 times, which is funny because they're really not one of my favorite bands, but they put on a good show and they almost always have bands with them that I want to see. But after Brocky died, I remember the first time I saw them, they had that Gwar woman or whatever. Oh, they were doing like the co-fronting thing. And then the Gwar woman just like disappeared.
You have to be careful with your terminology, Tom, because technically in like the mid to early 80s, there was a character called Gwar Woman.
That's right.
And her name was Gwar Woman. You're referring to Kim Deela, and her character was short-lived. I can't remember the name of her character in Gwar.
But yeah, they were doing a co-front person thing, and that was okay. And then the tour after that I saw was just the most uninspired. The storyline was so bad. And you got to have a good storyline. It was something like the back of the stage was like a giant iPad or something. And it was bad, man. They were touring with Battle Cross and I can't remember who else, but anyway, but the last couple times I've seen them,
I thought they were
really pretty good again. And I've enjoyed it. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to seeing Sacred Reich, who I've never seen. So it'd be cool. But anyway, Toxic Holocaust is playing that tour also. So, and my Boys Against the Grain from Detroit. Check it out, kids.
All right. So I guess we can kill this thing with a song if we got one. Todd.
Okay. Let's finish up. I've been playing. So the last two times I played songs, I played Child Bite songs. I want to play one more Child Bite song because Friday, the record's coming out with these songs on it. They recorded three new songs for the Split Hits fan. Number five, it's a split 7-inch series. It's Ringworm is on the A side with two songs, two not brand new songs, but they were two digital bonus tracks from their last album, which was Death Becomes My Voice. And this is the first time they're going to be available on vinyl, and this record comes out Friday. Like I said, Split Hits the Fans Volume 5, Ringworm and Child Bite. I'm going to play Child Bite. This is a brand new one, and it is called The Fool.
That was Child Bite, and that's it. Anything we want to leave it with? Any final words? Someone?
Listen,
if you ever get a chance to see Pete Best Band, don't miss it, kids.